bagels. Dunkin' bagels. Smash in the coffee. Dunkin' bagels. Dunkin' bagels.
Harden up, light the lights. You got nothing to hit but the heights. You'll be swell, you'll be great. Okay, all right, I promise not to sing anymore. If you promise to subscribe to Bridget's Bagel. I'm Bridget Grant, and this is my bagel. And that little rendition at the start is to mark the reopening of theatres. Not all of them. Not yet, but gradually they will be lifting the curtains on all of them, and you'll get to see everybody's talking about Jamie at the Apollo, Les Miserables, the stage concert at the Sondheim, and a new musical I'm dying to see, Amelie, based on the French film, which will be at the Criterion. And then, of course, there's...
We're one of a kind, no category. Too many years lost in history. We're free to take our crown in glory for 5 more minutes. We're six.
Yes, six is at the Lyric Theatre, which is the biggest auditorium it has ever been in. On that note, see what I did there? What better time could there be to talk to Mr. Kenny Wax, the inspired and prolific West End producer of Six and so many other shows that we've loved, still love and will love in the future. There's the play that went wrong, which obviously went right, hence all the Mischief Theatre spin-offs, the brilliant Top Hat and that kid's favourite, The Tiger Who Came to Tea. Kenny will be telling you about all of his productions, and best of all, he talks about the new ones. When COVID struck, like so many producers, Kenny Wax showed he cared for his productions and the people in them, and he stood up for the industry. He did a lot of standing up. Unfortunately, when we spoke, he was lying down because of his bad back. So if his audio goes a bit funny at times, please be patient, because what he says is damn interesting. He's insightful about the business and he gives the most valuable advice about buying tickets. You'll have to listen all the way through to the end for that. And along the way, you'll discover things you didn't know about.
We're six.
What a shame.
Yes, six. She said excitedly, and so much else. It's impossible to describe how much we have missed, particularly me, sitting in front of a stage. And I'd like to extend right now my good wishes and say break a leg to everyone involved in all the returning productions and the new ones. It's been a hell of a time, and in truth, it's not over yet. But could Kenny Wax ever have imagined such a crisis?
To be honest, no, because it is something which is so extraordinary. Nothing in the world could have prepared anybody for this sort of unimaginable occurrence, to be honest, Bridget. It is something that hopefully we'll never see again in our lifetime. If we can get through this in the next year or two properly through it and the world starts to return to normal. But it was totally unexpected. And you know, to literally not just the theatre industry, but the arts generally, and so many other industries that have suffered. And many haven't. You know, I've got friends who are lawyers and accountants who actually their business has been quite good. I've got friends who manufacture children's safety gear, stair gates and things like that, you know, with families at home all the time. Their businesses has been booming in the last year, 18 months. But when you have got closed venues and you can't allow audience to attend live events, it's an impossible situation for the live arts.
Is it hard to have conversations with people? Is it people doing well? I mean, isn't there something inside us that kind of dies when we hear something wonderful from people, even though we love our friends?
No, I don't actually really feel like that. It's a funny business, the theatre industry. I mean, I feel so lucky and blessed to have found something in my life to have done to suit my personality that's given me so much happiness, hopefully that's given a lot of joy to audiences, that I actually don't really feel like that. I just really want, you know, very happy for them and want to get our industry back up. I guess the only thing that we are wary of in our industry is government making rules for theatre which are more tight-reined than they are for other kind of events. So I guess you'd say when you've got a very well-managed building like a theatre with one-way systems and contactless ticketing and everybody in the audience sitting in the same direction, everybody with masks on and gaps between bubbles, family bubbles, and then you kind of go out to, you know, a high street or even outdoors, you see kind of people sitting at the pub in very, very close proximity or in restaurants facing each other. You kind of sometimes feel that the theatre industry is almost being prejudiced against, which is very unfair, because I do think that the senior theatre owners in the industry have been unbelievably diligent in the last 18 months trying to work their way through this, and have spent hundreds of hours talking to government, to DCMS, to the health officials, to professors, to scientists on things like ventilation, distances, aeration, kind of aerosol transmission of, you know, air in musical instruments and singing and that sort of thing. So feel the industry's really done its best, but sometimes it feels like we're not really being listened to.
How have you all come together? Because obviously there was Andrew Lloyd Webber and Nika Burns, people like that, who, and you're all in this industry together. Have you actually physically sat down at tables, or has it all been lots of Zoom calls to keep, you know, your shared mission going?
It's all been remote, to be honest, but I mean, I was just in this very extraordinary position of being the president of the Society of London Theatre, which I was elected to probably about 4 years ago now, very unexpectedly. I was asked if I would like to be considered. It was a huge honour in the industry. The Society of London Theatre is the trade body for the whole of the theatre industry in the West End. So it doesn't include the regional theatres, but it's from the National Theatre to the Coliseum, the Royal Albert Hall, all of the West End theatres, all of the affiliate theatres, which are theatres like the Donmar, the Almeida, the Bush, the Gate, the Lyric, Hammersmith. They're all members, and it encompasses the producing companies, the general management people, and also the theatre buildings, the theatre owners. So with about a year to go, 9 months to go or so of my presidency, the pandemic begun, and I found myself chairing board meetings literally once a week. We would normally have had board meetings every quarter of a year, so every 13 weeks, but suddenly such was the need, importance to be communicating much more frequently, that we were having these meetings every single week. And then in between, there would be other meetings, side meetings, meetings with DCMS, meeting with the culture minister, meeting with the officials. So, I mean, it wasn't Lloyd Webber himself, but he has a brilliant CEO of the LW Theatres group chain, Rebecca Kane Burton, who's been incredibly hardworking and a real force of nature, and working with one of their companies called Blakeney, who are a kind of political lobbyist company. So between Blakeney's, Rebecca at LW, Nika Burns, who's been working tremendously hard on behalf of her chain, NIMAX, they really kind of spearheaded the industry in terms of the science, the data, what the venues would have to do to reopen. And that nearly happened, of course, in December, and we were ready, and we did open for a few days. My friend Michael Harrison, who produces most of the major pantomimes around the country, including the London Palladium, was all geared up and set ready. We were with several of our productions, and of course that didn't happen. And, you know, we understand why, and it was probably the right reason, but often it's about communication or lack of it. And even now, we were so confident a week ago that we were going to open all of our theatres and get to full capacity. And that was very much the indication that the Prime Minister had made. And then on Monday last week, we had the first kind of real concerns over the spread of the India virus. And suddenly they're talking about, well, it should be fine to open the theatres, but we're not sure about social distancing, so we're going to wait a little bit longer. And, you know, the truth is that me, with some of my productions, many of my colleagues, we're going into pre-production in the next week or two, which means we gather all of the cast and all of the stage management in a rehearsal room, and we start rehearsing back to reopen the show. And that means that if it's a new show, its sets have got to be built. So it's a huge financial commitment about to happening literally right now, which if we end up continuing to be socially distanced, we just can't open some of those shows, not all of them. Six, we'll probably talk about a bit later, but it's a little bit different. We're very lucky. It's a mid-scale musical, but it can play to large-scale venues, and the economics work for that a little bit better than most, because the cast size is small and the band size is small. But kind of anything much bigger than six is very challenging to work in a socially distanced theatre where you've got literally 50% capacities.
And of course, you were due to open with six on Broadway at the time that this all started, and you've obviously got the Mischief Theatre Company who have also been there. Have you been liaising with America as well about the reopening?
Yeah, again, either every week, once a week, or twice a week sometimes on six and the Mischief shows. We had a Play That Goes Wrong running off Broadway, and we had a US tour of the Play That Goes Wrong that was cut short about 8 weeks before it finished. So actually that tour won't reopen with that cast, but there will be another tour going out again. So yes, I mean, they were quite a long way behind us in New York, because I think we were looking at the science, the data, the venues, what to do, probably quite a few months before they were. There was never any possibility of the New York theatres opening in December, which obviously, as we said, was the plan in London, but it didn't quite work out as we expected. So we've got a date actually for September the 17th to reopen in New York with six.
So that will be the official opening then, because
that's actually the first preview again. And then October the 3rd, which is, I think, a day after, no, the other way around. September 17th is just after Yom Kippur. And then October the 3rd is our official press night. So we did do 3 weeks of previews last time. And then it was actually shuttered on our actual opening night, 3 hours before the curtain was going to rise.
Oh my goodness. How do you handhold? I mean, obviously you're in the background is business people like yourself who have a passion for this industry. How do you handhold crying performers?
I think the whole country's been very realistic about this terrible year, 18 months that we've had. It's actually not quite right to say none of the actors have been None of them have been furloughed, but many of them have been able to get government grants, and some haven't. And it basically depended on whether you had been able to complete 2 years of tax returns prior to the pandemic year.
All right.
If you had, you were proving that you were a kind of working practitioner and the government were able to pay you a percentage of your salary that was, you know, reasonably significant, similar to the furlough situation. The problem was that if you just come out of drama school, or if you were perhaps just taken self-employed status or something like that, then you slipped through the cracks and you didn't get any government support. And we had reasonably regular Zoom meetings with our companies. And we always said to them, look, you know, we haven't got an endless pot of cash, particularly at this terrible time. But if anybody's got any real financial hardship, let us know and we'll help you out. And we have been able to do that across all of our shows. As it happens, not very many people have asked, but a few have, and we've been able to help where possible, and I think they'd be very grateful.
Did I read that six has the potential to become a movie?
There have been movie conversations with kind of major production companies. There have been conversations with television companies. I think everything will happen, to be honest, in time on that particular show.
I love that story about when we've met previously, you've told that story of going to see six for the first time with your daughter. Share that story.
So I've got a very good friend in the industry called George Stiles, who's a composer. George is a kind of godfather to Toby Marlowe, an old friend of Toby's dad. They used to play in a band together. George texted me one night, one day, I beg your pardon, to say, I've just seen this whip smart show. Could you get across to Cambridge? They're doing a couple more performances. I said, when is it? All by text. He said, it's actually 11 o'clock tonight and 11 o'clock tomorrow night. And I knew that the second performance we had plans. So I texted my wife and I said, you know, how do you feel about me going out late to Cambridge to see this new show that George has recommended? And in the background, I hear Jemima pipe up to say, oh, what's that? Where are you going? That sounds fun. Can I come too? So we set off on this journey at about 9 o'clock. She had like bedding in the car. She took pillows because it was so late. She was about 15 at the time or something like that. We met Toby Marley and Lucy Moss on the staircase of the Cambridge ADC Theatre. Before the show, it went up about 10 past 11, a bit late, with quite a buzz in the audience. They'd just come back from doing it in Edinburgh in a not very fashionable venue because they were unknown writers. So the bigger producers tend to book the better venues. And depending how far down you are in the food chain,
yeah.
I think they were almost playing in a corridor, actually, some sort of kind of function room of a hotel or something like that. So 12:15, the show came down and I turned to Jemima and I said, what did you think of it? And she said, I just thought it was amazing. And it was really at that moment that I knew that, as I'd had the same feeling, if a man in his 50s and a daughter in her kind of mid-teens could have the same response to this really unusual new musical, then we were onto something. So I arranged right then and there to meet Toby and Lucy in the office. A couple of days later, they came to my office. They explained that there'd already been some interest from one or two other producers. And once we got to know who they were, we decided to produce the show with them. That was a husband and wife team called Wendy and Andy Barnes. They'd actually seen the show in Edinburgh, so they were a couple of months ahead of us, actually. And then under George Stiles' guidance, who became a third producer, we arranged a kind of a deal and a way forward with Toby and Lucy to develop the show. And understandably, they'd produced the show with their friends being in the show. Toby's sister was in it and university friends. And really, they wanted to kind of take their friends along on the journey. And
we had
to explain, you know, we were about to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds on a new project. And although we'd thought the cast were terrific, they just didn't have drama school training and they particularly didn't have dance training because some of them were on English degrees and history degrees at Cambridge. But we did say we would bring them all in at the final auditions so at least they could kind of have a go and pit themselves against the women. And I think that kind of made them understand generally when they're in the dance auditions that they really were kind of, you know, a year or two behind in terms of training. Oh. And a couple of them, brilliant personalities and, you know, fantastic singers particularly and comedians. And, you know, maybe in the future we'll have a crack at it or do something else.
We're one of a kind, no category. Too many years lost in history. We're free to take our crowning glory for 5 more minutes. We're six. Whoa, whoa, we're six. Whoa.
Really, the studio album has driven the sales and the popularity of the show in a way that we couldn't have believed. And really, when people say it's an amazing journey, it is. From university production to opening on Broadway in 2.5 years, I do genuinely commend the album for being a huge part of that. We're just about to hit 250 million streams. So even though we've only been playing in the Tiny Arts Theatre for kind of a year and a half, 340 seats, when you consider the sort of reach that the album has managed to achieve, you can see that people well outside the theatre industry and theatre goers have heard about the show, listened to the music, and then maybe found out about the show. Normally it comes the other way around. You see the show by the album, but I think this way people were hearing the music and then coming to finding out about the show and coming to see the show.
Well, that was certainly our experience, and my daughter knew every word of it before we'd even seen it. She could sing the entire album. It was amazing. It was really amazing. And once you hear it once, you're completely there. Is that a case now? I mean, obviously, you haven't had that opportunity over the last 18 months, but is a big part of what you do, going to see things that have the potential to be another six? And are they hard to find?
I probably get, on average, one submission every single day of a kind of 5-day week. And whether it's to come and see somebody's show, or to read a script, or to have a meeting, we keep a list, literally, we log everything, just so I've got a kind of record of what's come in. And it's a few hundred in a year. So it's just not possible to follow everything up, to be honest. And mostly it's just a very polite email back saying, we really appreciate it, we are inundated, we are also under huge pressure getting our, you know, current shows back up and running. And we do genuinely have about 3 or 4 shows in development, which I can tell you about in a minute. And we just can't keep taking new shows on. But every now and again, there's something that comes through one way or another where you go, that, I really fancy that. So it's not to say to people, don't ever send me anything else, but it's so unlikely that we can embrace. Sometimes it will be, we know you're too busy, but could you give us some advice or suggest other producers, which I do in 1 or 2 cases. But I've got a staff of 20, which is already significant in a production company. That's quite a big office. Then we employ a few hundred people across the shows. And, you know, managing that staff, managing those productions, doing all the development work on the new shows, you just can't keep saying yes to everything. But as I said, every now and again, and it comes from all different ways. So Six was very unique in the way that it came to me through George's recommendation. One time, quite a few, 7 or 8 years ago, I had somebody who came to me. I'd really did the meeting out of a favour to an old university friend that I had. And she worked for an international rights company. I said, well, I'll do the meeting. And in fact, they said that they have the rights to the Parent Trap movies because their author, who was their client, deceased, wrote the original books. So that really pricked my interest. And in fact, next year, we will hopefully open that musical, the Parent Trap musical, which is called Identical. So we've rebranded it.
I saw you were looking for identical twins.
Yeah, we've got a few pairs now. And the truth is, we were going to open the show 2 years ago. So maybe 1 or 2 of those pairs are probably too old. I think we're still probably looking for 1 or 2 more pairs. But we've done a lot of work in the last 3 or 4 years with identical twins, which has been very interesting and great fun.
I'm sure. That's heartbreaking for them, though. I mean, you know, to have got that far and then the pandemic and then suddenly you're too old to play a kid.
That's a very, very typical situation in, you know, Mary Poppins, Miss Saigon, Les Mis, anything that, any show that uses young kids, you know, they get to a point and then they just become, either their voice breaks or they're too big or they're not cute enough or whatever it is, you know, and then...
Yeah.
And then the casting director, there's a very well-known children's casting director in the West End called Jo Hawes, and she's just used to dealing with all those situations, the parents, the local educational authorities, and so we use her to do a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I'm just picturing that poor kid that was just took up the mantle of Matilda, having learned all of Matilda, and then only to find that you've got 18 months that it's not going to be on.
Yeah, it really happens. To answer your other question, I mean, sometimes we have kind of brainstorming meetings in the office also. So although it's my company, you know, we've done probably 2 or 3 or 4 shows in the past, normally in the family entertainment world, that have come from those members of staff of mine that have got young kids, which I obviously did have 20 years ago when we started doing our family shows. But my kids are now very grown up. So, you know, to kind of be listening to your staff. And sometimes it's a relationship that you might have with a director or a writer, and you say, you know, well, what do you fancy doing? Or let's do something else again. So that's the way that projects generally seed in the first instance. And it's very unusual for something to come through the door from a totally unknown person, you know, as a bunch of songs or an idea. And generally when they do, that's not really the stuff that appeals to me.
Then there's no one dared to busk outside your window on Shaftesbury Avenue then. I know that with Spielberg, I've read that, you know, people that were keen to get hit their scripts noticed by him, they would come up with all these ingenious ways. And but he, you know, obviously always made a point of sending them back because he didn't want to be accused of any plagiarism. But I think I read that someone delivered a script where the it was wrapped in plastic at the bottom of an aquarium, and the entire aquarium was delivered to his office in Los Angeles, just so desperate to be seen. And that is it, because, you know, if you write, if you perform, and you know that there's someone, you know, who can make your dream. I mean, it's a bit like being a dream maker in a way, because that night when the curtains open and something that you've strived over, invested all your creativity in, is suddenly there in front of an audience. I mean, it's like you're a bit like, you know, the equivalent of being Willy Wonka or something. It's like you've taken them in like that.
It sounds very grand. Toby Marlowe and Lucy Moss never had any intention when they both were in their final year at Cambridge University writing Six to be musical theatre writers. That's not what they thought their career was going to be at all. And so I guess in that particular case, we literally did make dreams come true, and they've been all over the world directing and advising and supervising their productions. You know, we've got a couple of productions on the huge Norwegian cruise line ships, which they've been out to see. Next year, we will be opening the world tour in Manila. We'll be opening in Toronto. This year we're opening in Chicago, New York. Last year we opened in Australia. We've got the UK tour. You know, it's just been an incredible journey from a standing start.
And when those productions open in, say, Manila or somewhere like that, it's in the native language?
No, generally, if you imagine taking Les Mis as an example, in the first version of the production, in the iteration in a territory, you would probably wanting to try to do a UK replica production. So it would be identical to our production in look, and you would generally want it to be in the English language. Now, that might only be for a short period of time, particularly if, you know, a lot of the inquiries that come internationally are for own language productions, but we're just keen to do the initial production in that territory. It might only be for 3 or 4 weeks. But then if that really works and the local audiences like it, then we'll grant an own language license to follow up. So the world tour is going to go to Korea, China, Japan, Philippines, Hong Kong, and then around Europe. So the first few months will be in the Far East, and then it will come to Europe later on. I think Holland want a sit down production, so that will probably end up being in Dutch. But again, the first part of the world tour, the Dutch will get it in the English language, most likely.
Right. They haven't got it in Germany yet, because I like that the Hanover song would go down very nicely.
It's odd. I would absolutely expect it to be a big hit in Germany. It's just one of the markets that we've had conversations, but they've not kind of confirmed it yet. But I would absolutely expect they do tend to love the British musicals. What they'd make of kind of a Tudor king is another matter, to be honest.
No, that would be the sticking point. There are queens from so many countries. It's lovely. You've got the whole of Europe to play with there. That's nice.
I mean, just back to your other point, and in terms of the detail, I really do think that for anybody that listens to the soundtrack, the studio album of Six, or comes to see the show, if you really listen to the detail of the lyrics, it is a work of art. I mean, whether they'll ever write anything like that again, I don't know. It is a work of genius, in my opinion.
I was going to ask you that.
There is a nuance, there is a double entendre, there is a something. So all I was really going to say is it's going to be very hard in China and Japan and Hong Kong and the Philippines for us to figure out if the translations are really doing justice to the detail of the work that Toby and Lucy have done. And what normally happens is somebody translates it into the local language, and then you get somebody different to translate it back so that we can then read what they've written. And then you can try and kind of finesse the detail to understand if actually, you know, in that particular lyric, you can get a more poignant meaning, because it would be just a great shame if they end up getting a kind of literal translation without getting the colour and the brilliance of the actual, you know, like Don't Lose Your Head for Anne Boleyn is just a kind of great, and it's kind of got a couple of double entendres actually, and there's a mention of prêt-à-manger in there in French, which is, you know, which I just don't know how that would, I'm not sure if they have prêt-à-manger in Tokyo, but I guess we'll find out in the next few months.
Yeah, so you don't, yes, in other words, you don't want it to be a Google Translate version of the musical.
Really don't, no, quite.
Do you, it's interesting because you say that you don't know whether they'll ever write anything like that. So again, but you know, with Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber, obviously, you know, similar kind of background in the sense that you know, they were young students when they meet and develop their musicals. Do you think that some people only do have one big show?
Well, it is absolutely proven that some people do only have one absolutely classic musical. I would mention Frank Lesser, who wrote Guys and Dolls. There were one or two others, but that was so far and away. Others might disagree with me. Lionel Bart wrote other musicals like Maggie May and Things Ain't What They Used to Be. But really, Oliver is so far up ahead. And I think if you look at those two, and I'll tell you, Lerner and Lowe wrote My Fair Lady, and although there were one or two others, Brigadoon, it's often because the personality of the individual or writing team are so keyed into that particular subject matter. And the fact that kind of Toby and Lucy had this great interest in Tudor history and also pop music meant that it was, you know, absolutely their world. And I knew Lionel Bart quite well in the years before he died. And, you know, obviously he's a Londoner, he was an East Ender, he was an amazing man, what a life. And, you know, to write Oliver, a kind of boy who comes from, you know, an incredibly deprived background, to fall in with Fagin's gang and the, you know, Bill Sykes and the terror of all of that. And then on the other side of kind of Regent's Park, the Lionel really kind of understood that material. And look, we hope that Lucy and Toby have many, many wonderful years ahead of them. And I think different from Andrew and Tim, both of who I've worked with, both of who I know a little bit, both been very good to me in the years. They were friends and they worked together, and they've worked together very successfully on a number of different shows. But I think Toby and Lucy have an amazing bond that really kind of transcends a working relationship. They have a very, very deep friendship. They would say, and in fact, there was a piece in the Sunday Times today, big article about them in the Sunday Times today, which, you know, they're almost like a married couple because they'd spend a huge amount of time together. They can literally finish each other's sentences. They're very close. And, you know, so it's much more than just a kind of business relationship, I think, for them. And for those who, you know, look at the Lloyd Webber work, or I do or I don't like, I mean, the diversity of Lloyd Webber's work over the years, from writing things like Requiem and Tell Me on a Sunday, a song cycle, and, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar, which was incredibly ahead of its time at the time, and The Genius of Evita, and then obviously starting with Joseph at the very beginning, which was very much kind of school's fun show. And then again, the brilliance of Andrew, not with Tim, but shows like Sunset Boulevard and Phantom. You know, there's a huge wide range of work. And although there have been a number of misses in between, I don't think anyone can write 15 or 20 shows which are all going to have the same level of success. So I think Andrew is an incredible exponent of trying different things. I mean, even, you know, Starlight Express and Cats were totally generationally things out of their time. I worked on Cats for a couple of years as a kind of in my first years after graduating as a follow spot operator, and just seeing the buttons that show pushed, and as a dance show, it was something that we'd never really seen before. And then Starlight Express, again, many people's, not many, but perhaps not the favourite of, but, you know, as a spectacle with roller skates. I mean, who would have thought you could put a show on stage on roller skates? They're just brilliant ideas and, you know,
extraordinary,
original at the time. And hope that Toby and Lucy do come up with lots of different and inventive ideas over the years to come.
I mean, I suppose if there's a way, I mean, not that people need to be pushed back to the theatre, but knowing they're seeing something, you know, extraordinary and original, which Six, you know, truly has been in recent years. If there were, of all your favourite musicals, is there one that you would love to put on, and who would you love to cast? You can draw from any time in musical history.
I'm not really going to answer that question, because actually the things that I'm genuinely most excited about are the shows that I'm literally working on kind of right now, which are in most cases original, new original works.
Musicals are coming.
New musicals are coming, and you know, sometimes it's plays with songs, and sometimes it's, you know, kids shows with songs. Yeah, there's lots of work coming on.
Anything you can tell or talk about?
Well, I'm really excited about obviously my identical project with my identical twin. So that that opens in Nottingham next summer and then goes to Manchester. It's going to be directed by Trevor Nunn, who directed Les Miserables, along with many, many other big hit shows. We used to run the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Company. Oh. You know, what he hasn't done hasn't been done. So that's a big thrill to be working with somebody like Trevor. Later on in the year, we've got this fantastic new musical, which is going to open in Southampton. It's going to do about 10, 12 weeks, Southampton, Norwich, and then Liverpool Playhouse over Christmas. So it's our newest musical. It's got a kind of vaguely similar idea to Six. So it's called Fantastically Great Women Who Changed the World. So that's a nice, neat, short title for you.
Does that fit on a hoarding? Does it fit?
It will fit on a hoarding somehow. It's based on a children's book that one of my office colleagues produced a few years ago. The book was written and illustrated by Kate Pankhurst, and the clue is in the surname, because Kate is a distant relative of Emmeline Pankhurst, who, of course, was the suffragette. So in this book, every page you turn, there's an incredibly great woman. So it includes Emmeline Pankhurst, Gertrude Adele, who was the first person to swim across the Channel, Amelia Earhart, who was the first person to fly across the Atlantic, Rosa Parks, who of course famously didn't stand up on the bus and led the civil rights movement in America. Anne Frank is in there in a small but beautiful way at the end of the show. There was an incredible American explorer, South American explorer called Sacagawa, who kind of took American, they thought they were kind of discovering new lands, but actually she knew the lands that she was taking them to. So all of these unbelievable women, Mary Curie's in there, of course, with her incredible
work
for cancer, and Mary Seacole, who was a British Jamaican nurse who went to work in the Crimean War. And all these women, it's not quite the same as Six. They've all not got their own songs. It is a kind of a historical retelling, but it's seen through the eyes of a young 9-10-year-old girl who escapes from her school party on the school trip at the big local museum, and whereas they're all looking elsewhere, she goes into a gallery which hasn't yet been opened, and it's called the Gallery of Greatness, and it's where all these women are going to be exhibited. And the women come to meet her, sometimes one by one and sometimes in groups.
Oh, wow.
So they kind of come back to life, and they give her an incredible life lesson of how she's going to be an amazing woman in her own way, whatever that is.
It's a very empowering
show. The difference to Six is that with Six, they're a pop group, you know, it's kind of Little Mix, the Spice Girls, whatever, you know, coming to do a concert. But with this, it's really seen through the eyes of this child and these incredible women that come in some cases to tell her their story, which she doesn't know, and in some cases she has heard of them, she's learnt about them in school. I guess the similarity is that it's a pop musical. There are 7 or 8 pop songs. They're written by an incredible writer called Miranda Cooper, who has had more British number one songs for women than anyone else in history. She's written for Sugar Babes, Kylie Minogue, Alicia Dixon. So she's been working on the music, and the songs are absolute bangers, is the expression we use nowadays, Bridget, bangers.
That's brilliant. It's all different periods as well. So the costume, it allows the costume department to have a good time as well.
Yeah, I'm going to see, as a producer, you get a few thrilling moments when you produce a show. And one of them is the presentation of something called the white card model. And the white card model is something that the designer produces. So you employ a designer, and then you send the designer away to work with the director. And then a few months later, and a few months before the show is going to open, they come back with their ideas, but they don't just sketch them onto a piece of paper. They actually build a model set within the proscenium of a theatre that you might be going to. So you can actually see how the furniture can move, and how the trucks, which are the kind of the pieces on wheels or on wires, can move, and the flown pieces can come in from the ceiling. So I think on Tuesday we got our white card model showing, and probably in that they'll tell me about the costume designs, which, yes, need to have a contemporary flair, but also need to be kind of set in the period. So a combination of the two.
So it's a woman lyricist and composer for the music, and then virtually all female cast, presumably. Is it a woman director as well?
I'm very embarrassed to say I'm the only man involved in the entire production. And that's because I'm commissioning it and paying everybody. Because it's called Fantastically Great Women Who Changed the World. So we've just felt if we can't, with that show, give opportunities for women designers. So we've literally got female director, female writer, female lyricist, female composer, female music producer, female lighting, sound, set, costume, production manager, you know, and then all my office staff who are working on it are women too.
Oh, so wow. That's
the big female team.
Being around theatre people as much as you are, I don't know what your children are now doing, but I mean, is it a business you would encourage young people to go into?
I was just very lucky because I was just given an opportunity by my parents. I did a business studies degree. They would have liked me to go into something more conventional. And I really wanted to try my hand at, and I said at the very beginning, to be a theatre producer, but I knew that I had to learn along the way. So it wasn't like I started producing in the first or second year. It probably took me maybe 3 years to produce a little Sunday night concert. But all the while I was building up experience and knowledge. And there was no way of knowing then how it would ever turn out. And again, I'm very blessed. I'm very lucky because it has worked for me to a certain extent. It is a really difficult industry. I would generally say, and I've had friends of mine who are parents of youngsters, of kind of kids my age or younger, who've said, our child really wants to go on stage, you know, what would you advise? And I tell them the story of how I was, you know, given this opportunity. My dad was quite tearful, moved. He was very sensitive to the fact that he was a very bright man, and he had never gone out on a limb to do anything which was more challenging. He'd taken over his father's business. It was a kind of small family business in Manchester, kind of finance company. He was an amazing man, very much kind of loved in the community. But in work terms, he never really kind of pursued an ambition. And that was for the benefit of his wife and the children, to put us through private school, which we were very lucky to have. And that was a way to kind of ensure a certain, I guess, level of, you know, kind of finances to bring up that family in a way that he wanted to. When we went into the industry, and my brother also went into the theatre initially as a director and then moved across into television drama producing, and has had quite a lot of success and ups and downs like I have along the way also. It's a very up and down industry. So I generally say to those parents, look, if that's what they want to do, give them a chance. You know, don't let them leave school without a proper education. Maybe they'll even do a university degree first, but maybe not. If they can get into one of the top drama schools, if that's all they really want to do, then, you know, if they have to start a different career two or three years later, then so be it. But in the meantime, I think it's incredibly sad to stifle a brilliant creative spirit. And I've had, you know, friends of mine that have gone into acting and then gone into television, or gone into theatre as an actor and then become, you know, again, a producer of a production company. So quite often, if you're savvy, one thing can lead to another. I'll also always say you need a second string. That might be that you're brilliant on, you know, social media. We are forever looking for people to join our company who are much better on social media than we are, because that's obviously the way that selling our shows is going. So, you know, kids that are brilliant at Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and TikTok might have some design skills. They might have a little bit of graphic design skills. They might be able to copyright. And if you can do all of those things, there is no shortage of companies in the theatre, in the arts, who would take you on maybe 1 or 2 days a week, or 2 or 3 hours a day or something like that, to help sell their shows. So I would say don't bother waiting tables, because you're not really going to learn anything, but learn the union rule books. Go and volunteer at you know, or go and work front of house or backstage as a crew member, like I did as a follow spot operator, or go and work in a box office, because ticketing is a really important part of the industry. Learn something that is a related skill rather than just, you know, literally waiting tables.
Right. Yeah. So when you go and collect your tickets, when you go to pick your tickets up at the box office, you never know that the person sitting behind there may be the future star of a musical or a play or something.
They're more likely to be actually in a call centre. Right. I mean, Jonathan Burke, who is one of the Mischief originators, writers, stars of the show, he's the little one, if anyone knows the Mischief world. But, you know, he was working in a call centre, you know, while they were writing their first shows, because everyone needs to earn some money. Most people do anyway. I wasn't very good. I worked at the New London in the box office for a few months on and off. But it was interesting, you know, and I learned something. You know,
you've been learning all the way, haven't you? You've been a kind of pupil of the business and, you know, learning all the way through. Are you much of a teacher?
Insofar as the sorts of questions that you're asking, that I've been able to give out advice, it's very rare that if somebody says, could I come to see you, that I'll say no. There'd have to be a reason. I'd like to think that I'll always give time to anybody that wants my time. So whether it's on a Zoom call or a phone call or people come to see me, I think in the future I will start increasingly giving some of those roles to some of my staff to have those conversations, because my time has just become increasingly short and valuable. But I do remember when I was starting out, my parents had a really good contact into somebody very high up the industry. They actually knew the person's brother. And they said, you know, we've got a really good contact. Our son is desperate to be a commercial producer. Would your brother meet our son? So I wrote to him and he said no. And I just thought I would never, ever do that to somebody else. You know, a young person wanting to start out in the industry who wants, you know, kind of advice, even if it's 15 minutes. And on the other flip side, I wrote a letter to Cameron McIntosh when I was 21, when I was ushering at Miss Saigon, which had just opened, and he gave me an hour and a half of his time. That was really what kind of inspired me to kind of go on the journey.
Are you still friends?
I don't know if friends is the word. I mean, yes, I'm extremely grateful and fond. I can pick up the phone to him. I spoke to him a few weeks ago. You know, we're not social friends. I've not been on his yacht. I don't get invited to all the parties. But he does consider me, I think, with some affection, because of a new generation of producers, I felt that he kind of has given me a lot of advice along the way. I've got into trouble once or twice, not trouble, but kind of financial straits. And I've kind of called him and said, what do I do now? Help. And, you know, one time he gave me some brilliant advice, which I took, and we got out of that one. Another time he actually loaned me quite a big sum of money.
Wow.
Which, you know, it was totally unexpected, and I paid it back kind of a year later. And he said, Kenny, I've loaned a lot of money out in this industry over the years. Nobody's ever paid me back. You're the first person.
Really?
To me, it wasn't even I was never, ever not going to pay it back, but it just kind of helped me get through. So, you know, I mean, so he's always been a kind of mentor to me.
If they were going to write a musical about you, I mean, obviously, you know, you haven't been married to Henry VIII or, you know, or flown across the Atlantic in a single engine plane. What would your musical be? What would it be? What, you know, it was about you.
Don't do it. I would just tell them, don't do a musical about me. I don't know, there might be a biography or a memoir, boring memoir sometime in, you know, 20 years time. Maybe I'll write something down at one point. But
you don't write anything down. You haven't written anything. You haven't kept a diary or anything.
No, I've not really. And I have met some amazing people along the way, you know, from royalty to American presidents to British prime ministers to pop stars to, you know, Elton John to Cliff Richard to Barry Manilow to Anthony Hopkins. I met Prince Charles, shared a royal box with Camilla, Prince Edward.
Buckingham
Palace. But, you know, it's just kind of amazing things to enjoy in the moment. There's no bigger thrill than producing a show that people want to see. That moment of knowing that you've brought something amazing. And we did it, you know, I've been lucky enough, did it with Top Hat a few years ago, which won the Olivier that year for best new musical. And although it was based on Irving Berlin's brilliant songbook catalogue. It was a really, really good adaptation of the movie that we did. We just got an email last week saying that the company in Japan that did the show in 2015 want to do it again. So that's quite fun, quite exciting. You know, right now we're remounting Peter Pan Goes Wrong in Canada, Play That Goes Wrong for a UK tour, Play That Goes Wrong in the West End, Grown Ups for a UK tour, Magic Goes Wrong, which is our Penn and Teller show in the West End, Magic Goes Wrong on tour. Hopefully Magic Goes Wrong in America next year. There are literally dozens of productions, you know, when you talk about Six and all the Mischief stuff and all the new work.
That's it. Well, thank you for telling me about all the upcoming shows and the people that you've met. I might say that having met Elton John, if there's anything there of substance, because I just saw the price of the tickets to see him at the O2 later this year. And frankly, unless you want to remortgage, I won't be going.
But yes, I'm sure that many concert prices will be going through the roof over the next
year. Oh my goodness, yeah.
And what we really try to do, just again, blowing our own trumpet, which I try not to do in many ways, but all of our shows keep ticket prices at a real level. I mean, theatre is very expensive at whatever price, but if you look at any of our productions, they'll be literally the lowest prices across all of the West End theatre. And I do believe that's why some of our shows have been as popular as they've been, because people come back, they really enjoy them, and it's not cost them the arm and leg, and they haven't had to remortgage, and they've recommended to friends and family. And then sometimes they've come back with friends and family to experience the show again. So, you know, I really rally against the prices of 90, 100, 120, 150, £200 a ticket. And our shows tend to have most of the tickets at the kind of 50, 55 at the top. And sometimes we do some premiums that are a little bit more. But I always say, you know, don't buy the premiums unless they're the last tickets there. Buy your cheaper tickets 2 weeks in advance, just plan ahead. Premiums really are for tourists that come to London that will have a very short window of time, that, you know, see the show at any price. But really, I would say never buy the premiums, always buy the regular top price tickets, which we try to keep. And always try to buy, by the way, from the theatre owner or the theatre production company. Try to make sure you're not buying from the ticket agents, who will be charging markups. And quite often the ticket agents can be very clever. So there's a company called From the Box Office. Well, you think you're buying from the box office, don't you? No, you're not. That's just they bought the domain name. They're charging an extra £20 on a ticket. You don't need to spend that money. So if you can just double check who the production company is, normally the production company will have the title of the show in the web page. So Six the Musical. But you wouldn't buy From the Box Office Lyric Theatre. That's not either the theatre or the show. That's a ticket agent.
Yeah, I think it's really good. That is extremely good advice. And certainly I remember being in New York and thinking, you know, all these crazy prices for shows, actually walking into the theatre itself, going to the box office and not believing it was even possible, saying it was this Bette Midler in Hello Dolly, can I have tickets for tonight? And they said, yes, we've got some here on the mezzanine that were a quarter of the price that I could have bought them on, you know, at any ticket booth.
Amazing.
Anyway.
They probably had them returned from, you know, the production company, or maybe a ticket agent hasn't managed to sell them or something like that. So it really is always worth, you know, walking in at the theatre, because every producer, we hold 8 or 10 tickets back for the day, you know, for friends and family or industry colleagues. It might be a big movie producer or a big movie star or a pop star. And we get a call by the office, oh, such and such wants to come. You just don't want to be in a world say, well, we haven't got anything. So we're always, you know, between ourselves and the theatre, we've got probably 4 tickets up our sleeve till an hour or two before the curtain.
Right. Well, that's worth knowing. That's worth it. Yeah. I must say, I booked tickets over 18 months, 3 times for Six. Once when I thought, well, we already had them, and then that cancelled, and then it was the net. And so it's literally, so it's there. It's like there on the calendar. We will get back.
I don't know you're going, Bridget, but do come. You're probably going in the first few weeks when we're social distance, but do try and come when we're not so distant, because to see the Lyric Theatre, because this is the new production now with the new build and the new lighting. So to see that absolutely full rather than at 50% capacity. So hopefully, keeping all fingers crossed from June the 21st, full capacity, it will just be like the most amazing experience, a full theatre with that show, with the auditorium absolutely rocking.
Sadly, it seems, if you want to see Top Hat, you'll have to go to Japan. But en route, you could catch Peter Pan Went Wrong in Canada. The Mischief Company's play that goes wrong has played on every continent except Antarctica. But that's only because it might get a cold reception. Sorry, that was Kenny's joke. It wasn't mine. But you have to laugh. He was very generous to share all that stuff about buying tickets. Now you must feel compelled to buy tickets to see what the ladybird heard at the palace. You might also want to take your little ones to Oi Frog, which is coming back. Well, depending on how you say it, Oi Frog could be about a Jewish amphibian. That was also Kenny's joke. I'm delighted he brought so much warmth, generosity and humour to my bagel. Actually, I think that when we can all remove our masks in theatres, a bagel is a suitably silent food to consume, unlike the wrapped boiled sweet. And yes, I have sat in front of people who eat wrapped boiled sweets through crucial parts of plays. I wouldn't be missing them if they didn't come back. Anyway, Kenny's favourite bagel would be the egg mayo. So you'll know what to bring him when you take a bagel to see him and pitch that musical. Sorry, Ken, I had to say that. I know that they'll be welcomed. Thanks for listening. And there'll be more fun filling next time in Bridget's Bagel with me, Bridget Grant.
Dunkin' Bagel, Dunkin' Bagel, smash in the coffee.